Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Organizers of the effort to recall Governor Gavin Newsom have until March 17th to collect signatures and say they are already close to the 1.5 million required to put the recall on the ballot. Just ahead on today's show, we'll discuss what's next in the process. Should enough signatures be gathered, valid signatures, and how this recall movement compares to the only other time in state history a gubernatorial recall effort went before voters. It succeeded, and we'll speak with the man who lost his job because of it, former Governor Gray Davis. But first, today is the start of the second impeachment trial against former President Donald Trump. He is charged with inciting an insurrection that took place at the Capitol back on January 6th, about a month ago. NPR will begin special coverage of this trial just after Insight, starting at 10, so stick around for that. Joining us now with a preview is the political junkie, Ken Rudin, here to discuss history in the making, as Trump is the first president to be impeached twice and face a trial after his term ended. A couple of historic firsts there. Ken, as always, great to speak with you.
Good morning, Randall. A lot of history here.
That's for sure. So help us understand, for those of us, you know, who don't follow every twist and turn in Washington, the differences between last year's impeachment efforts and what we're about to see today.
Well, I think one thing is definitely different is that the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate, have worked out an agreement. They seem to be more on the same page now than they did before. Basically, last time, the last impeachment, which was, of course, that very perfect conversation to folks in Ukraine about unearthing dirt on Joe Biden. Both sides were really at odds from the beginning. The Republicans refused to call witnesses. There was a lot of vitriol that just didn't help the process at all. This one, even though the parties are still far apart on the guilt of President Trump, at least the two parties led by Mitch McConnell, the former majority leader, and Chuck Schumer, the new majority leader, seem to be more cordial.
Yeah, and there has been not a lot, but some show of support from the other side of the aisle, the Republican side of the aisle. We spoke with constitutional law expert Leslie Jacobs a few weeks ago about what to expect for the impeachment process. And here's a little bit of what she had to say, and then I'll have you follow up behind that, Ken.
I'll just point out here, we have about five options being batted around about what to do about the events and the president and his behavior. And all five of them have one fatal flaw attached to them, and that's that they need a significant number of Republicans to go along with it. And if we don't have a significant number of Republicans going along with any of these options, then A, it won't happen, or B, if it does happen, it's not going to have the moral or the practical durability that one would think that the people bringing it would want.
So a couple of things there, Ken. What do you think about her take on it?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, look, the Democrats, I think most people know, and the Democrats will acknowledge, that they won't be 17 Republicans who will join 50 Democrats to vote to convict. I mean, I don't think anybody seems to think that'll happen. That trial balloon that Rand Paul had 2 weeks ago, basically, it was a point of order calling the trial unconstitutional. We saw 45 out of 50 Republicans voting that it was unconstitutional. So if you're going to get 40, you can only get five Republicans at the time who say, yes, the trial should go on. It's hard to imagine the fact that 17 would go along with a guilty verdict. But having said that, the Democrats, I think, feeling at the very least, by bringing this argument, by showing not only what happened on the days of January 6th, a day of January 6th, but even days before that, the then president's intent to overturn a fair and democratically held election by talking to officials, election officials in Michigan, in Georgia, and calling the vice president, calling for the vice president, Mike Pence, to do his job to save the republic. I mean, I think the Democrats, if nothing else, they want to put the Republicans on notice that this is the kind of thing, the kind of behavior that they are going to either defend or reject.
Leslie Jacobs mentioned five options there. Can you walk us through a few of those, the more important ones?
I think I unfortunately that was the tape. The sound was breaking up as she spoke, so I kind of didn't hear everything she said. I apologize.
No, that's okay. She was essentially saying that as the trial gets underway, there are several different paths that the Democrats can take. One of the first things we should point out is that this trial is not a criminal trial. Why is that important to know?
Well, I mean, I think this is basically the Republican argument. The Republican argument is that it's a political trial and it's a political sham. And given the fact that he's a former president, that the only thing the Democrats are trying to do is embarrass the president, because obviously you can't remove him from office because he's already out of office. The Democrats say that is nonsense, that there have to be consequences for a president, for example, in his final weeks in office. Does that mean he could do whatever he wants, say whatever he wants, and there are no consequences? So that's the kind of the difference between the two sides of the argument here.
Doesn't it also mean, though, that the standards are different? So when you get to, saying that the president didn't break the law when it comes to inciting the riot, it's a different standard than you would have in a criminal trial.
Well, that is very true. But we have to remember that by definition, impeachment is a political offense. You don't arrest somebody and charge them with an impeachment. You basically, for example, if you look at what's going on with the Southern District in New York and perhaps the District Attorney of Manhattan and the U.S. Attorney in Southern District, there are criminal cases that may be made against the former president regarding taxes and finances and things like that. But basically, this is as the Democrats in the House say, the House managers say that this is an incitement to riot and an attempt to overturn a democratically held election. And look, why convict somebody like that? Because he's already out of office. The purpose, of course, if you convict him, then you could have the vote barring him, Donald Trump, from ever serving in office again. And that's basically the only thing that the Democrats can get out of this. But you're absolutely right, Randall. I mean, there's a tremendous difference between political ramifications and criminal ramifications. And in any kind of impeachment, it is really more about politics than anything else.
Yeah, there are two audiences here. There's the Senate, of course, right? And then there's the American public who will digest some of the information presented.
That's a very important point. And yes, the audience is the Senate because you have to peel away, or at least the Democrats feel they have to peel away enough Republicans to vote to convict. Look, and if you go to Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton and the first Donald Trump impeachment, there was no conviction by the Senate. Andrew Johnson came only within a vote, and his temerity was firing the Secretary of War without the consent of Congress. I mean, that sounds kind of silly a little bit, and you know, it's like you're giggling compared to inciting an insurrection that caused the deaths of five people and trying to overturn a democratically held election. I mean, that goes beyond belief. But I mean, look, the fact is that what Donald Trump is being charged with goes beyond what any other president has been charged with. And the other audience, in addition to, and look, let me stick with the president, the senators for a second. The senators are well aware that 10 Republicans during the House impeachment vote, 10 Republicans voted to impeach, and at least all 10, led by Liz Cheney, have been a subject of tremendous retribution by voters back home. We saw the ugly incident of Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida, leading an anti-Liz Cheney rally in Cheyenne, Wyoming last week. Basically, there are a lot of Republican challengers who are already stepping forward to challenge, to take on these 10 Republicans who voted to impeach. So a lot of it is very possible that many of these Republican senators who have to judge the merits of the case here are very aware that the Trump voters remain to be very loyal, and their political future could be on the line should they vote to convict.
Ken, the Constitution does not have a lot of details for how to carry out impeachment. One of the few specifics, I guess, that it does provide is that when the president of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice will preside. But Chief Justice John Roberts isn't presiding. So how does that work?
Well, my understanding is the reason John Roberts is not presiding is that Donald Trump is no longer the president of the United States. So the Senate president pro tem of the majority party in the Senate, which means the most senior Democrat of the majority party, and that's Pat Leahy of Vermont, he will preside over the trial. And the Republicans are saying, oh, wait a second, this shows it's fixed from the beginning. I mean, of course, they'll say that. What's fascinating about what the Republicans are doing is that they will either question the fact that it's unconstitutional to hold the trial, or everything that Donald Trump said on January 6th is protected by freedom of speech, the First Amendment. But the Republicans are not saying what he said and the conduct he did is defensible. And it's so very interesting. The Republicans are trying to go around the real issue here is instead of talking about and focusing on what Trump did to overturn an election, basically they're saying, well, it's not constitutional and he can say what he wants. That's what they said with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Marjorie Taylor Greene, for goodness sakes, called for the execution of Nancy Pelosi, talked about that, had these anti-Semitic insane theories, talked about the fact that the slaughter of children in Connecticut was a fantasy. I mean, but everybody, and most of the Republicans said, well, we're not going to punish her because it's free speech. I mean, that's fine and dandy, but the fact is that I think the American people, and that goes to your earlier question, the other audience, the American people, I think the Democrats want to show if this is what the Republican Party stands for, the fact that they will accept this kind of behavior by a Republican president, then maybe perhaps the voters in 2022 and beyond will take notice. And that's why it goes to the bigger question, that the fact is that this is a political trial.
The single article of impeachment sent to the Senate was for incitement of insurrection. Did the House consider other articles?
They did. As a matter of fact, the things I talked about, as far as the other things that Donald Trump has done, the trying to reach out to the election officials in Michigan and Georgia, people like that, trying to overturn the election. I mean, he's on tape. The former president is on tape saying to Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad, I need 11,000 votes to win the state. I mean, I never heard. You know, you think of Nixon and you think of all the corruption in American history. Nobody, no president ever tried to overturn an election by trying to discard the will of millions of voters. And that's the scary part. And I think that's the part that the Democrats are going to focus on the most. And what I think the millions of people watching at home will take from all of this.
Right. So, Ken, do you think that the Democrats will, while they certainly will focus on the former president's speech the day of the rioting, to build the argument that it wasn't just what the president said that day, but that it was a long list of things that had been said and done over the course of a few months, they'll use that opportunity to work in these examples that you've pointed out.
Absolutely. Randy, you're absolutely right. They're going to try to show that what Donald Trump has done, it's a systemic effort to overturn the will of the voters. He said from the beginning that he would not promise to a peaceful transfer of power. A lot of his rhetoric, a matter of fact, a lot of the people who were arrested at the Capitol in the aftermath of January 6th said, well, we did what the president instructed us to do. Now, of course, you know, that doesn't mean necessarily that Trump is at fault, but they felt that this was instructions from the president. But basically, it is not just about January 6th. It's, you know, from the day, even before the election, it's going to be a fixed election. They're stealing it from us. He's talked about everything he's tried to do. He brought lawmakers from Michigan to the White House to see if what they could do to overturn the results. I mean, it's basically a systemic effort to to overthrow basically an elected government and just make sure that, I mean, what's remarkable is that he is it's incitement of insurrection against his own government. I mean, he was president when he tried to do this. He wasn't an outsider trying to overthrow a government, but he was trying to overthrow the will of the people. And that's what the Democrats are trying to argue.
It's going to be an interesting few days. And just quickly, Ken, you think it'll just be a few days?
It could go beyond Friday. For example, today is all about the constitutionality of it, and there'll be 4 hours to debate. Once they pass this bill, once they vote yes, which is most likely, then starting tomorrow, they'll go into the arguments of the case. There were 16 hours of arguments of both sides. Then there were arguments about whether to have jurors or not. Then there were closing arguments. So I think Friday is optimistic, but I think early next week may be it. Some Democrats want to get it over with. Joe Biden, you notice, hasn't even said a word about this because he has a whole program and to implement. But the Democrats don't want this to go away quickly. They want to make sure they make the case, because whether Trump is convicted or not, these are serious charges that the American people and the Senate needs to hear.
That's the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin, of course, at a regular here on Insight. Thanks for joining us, Ken, as always.
Thanks, Rand. I'll see you at the next impeachment, which should be in a few months from now.
All righty. Up next, a closer look at the recall effort against Governor Gavin Newsom, how the recall process works and how this current recall compares to when former Governor Gray Davis was recalled in 2003. You're listening to Insight here on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. Back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and a very good Tuesday to you. Our big conversation today is the recall movement against Governor Gavin Newsom. Recalls are not uncommon. Voters are able to scrutinize elected officials and within that allowed to have them voted out of office through the recall process. In California alone, there have been 178 recall movements against elected officials, 55 of those specifically against governors. Out of those 55, only one has gone all the way to the ballot box in California, and in that case was successful in voting out then-Governor Gray Davis in 2003. And we spoke with the former governor yesterday, and we'll cue that conversation up for you in just a few minutes. But first, here to give us an update on the current recall movement against Governor Gavin Newsom is Cap Radio's politics reporter and host of California State of Mind, Nicole Nixon. Hello, Nicole.
Hey, Randall.
So where are we signature-wise? What's needed and where are we at?
Yeah, so the recall organizers say that they have collected about 1.4 million signatures. Remember, they need just under 1.5 million valid signatures. These groups always want to have a cushion to, you know, account for people who may have mistakenly signed when they're not registered to vote, things like that. So they said that their goal is 1.8 million. And they've got, you know, just a few hundred thousand more to go to reach that goal and get them turned in by the mid-March deadline, March 17th.
Do we have data around the main reasons why people are signing the recall petition?
You know, we don't have hard data, but we have I've talked to some of these people who've signed the petition. We have new polling data that came out last week. these are all over the map. You know, recall organizers have disliked Newsom for a very long time. The guy behind this has filed, I think, two or three recall attempts against Newsom. But they have really been able to tap into the anger over the pandemic restrictions, mm-hmm. you know, the business closures, all of those things. The new ones that people are starting to get really upset about are schools are still closed in California and the vaccine rollout hasn't been going great. The numbers are looking better for California. But you know, if Newsom has a do or die time here in the next few months to do some of these things. And the other thing I say on this is, you know, if a recall gets on the ballot, we are likely looking at a recall election this fall. There's just so much that could happen between now and then. It's anybody's guess, like how angry people will still be and how much they'll want to take that out on the governor, I guess.
It's all about timing, striking when the iron's hot, I guess. According to the state's constitution, Governor Newsom cannot run to replace himself in the recall election. But there is one question that says whether you believe the governor should be recalled or not. And I guess that's, in essence, him running. Right. Are there any Democratic contenders who might throw their hat into the ring should this make it all the way to the ballot?
You know, we haven't seen any serious Democratic challengers yet. That doesn't mean that there won't be any. I guess we'll just have to wait and see and see if Newsom continues to please his Democratic base, basically. Newsom is still popular among Democratic voters. A couple polls came out last week. We see that about 70% of California Democrats still approve of Newsom and say that they would vote to keep him in office. That's pretty good for him. There are also no party preference voters. You know, they make up about a quarter of California voters. They mm-hmm. are very largely split, but the largest group say that they would vote to keep Newsom in office.
Mm-hmm. We should mention that back in 2003, California Lieutenant Governor at the time, Cruz Bustamante, ran in that recall effort and got about a third of the vote. So when that happened, when Governor Gray Davis was recalled, there were more than 100 people who submitted their candidacy for governor. Are we expecting possibly that sort of cattle call situation this time around?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are that many. Again, we will have to wait and see. But I think that that's just how these things go. It's a rare thing. It's a very novel, you know, interesting moment in politics. People, the threshold to get on the ballot isn't high. You really just have to sign up and be 18, I believe.
Yeah.
So, you know, people sign up and get on the ballot and do their thing. I will say, though, you talked about last time, when the lieutenant governor Bustamante ran and took some votes away from the governor, where people blamed him for that. But we do have two of the highest profile Republicans in California already saying that they will run in the recall. Former San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner mm-hmm. and John Cox, who ran against Newsom in 2018. They are both already campaigning against Newsom and against each other. So if they are both, you know, on the recall ballot and going against each other, they could split that Republican vote.
Yeah, unlike 2003, when there was a big star and a very recognizable name in Arnold Schwarzenegger, that doesn't seem to be the case this time around, at least yet.
Exactly, and that is what I've heard also several times, is that Schwarzenegger factor really was the big, you know, wild card that helped him so much. And just right now, we don't have a candidate like that we've seen, you know, go out there. There was this tech former Facebook executive, Chamath Palihapitiya, who expressed some interest and people got really excited about, but he's already come out and said he wasn't really seriously running for the recall. And
interesting.
On other things now.
So on May 17th, Nicole, they go through the signatures and try to validate as many as they can.
Yeah, I've got some. So the
March
deadline
17th,
to
rather.
Turn
mm-hmm.
March 17th, and then county election officials have until the end of April to verify those signatures. Then there are some other, you know, deadlines, like there's a period where people can withdraw their signatures. They get over a month to do that. Mm. You know, a lot of these other sort of behind the scenes bureaucratic type deadlines. the people I talk to say that we would, you know, if this makes it on the ballot, we'd be looking at November, you know, sometime in November, probably.
Yeah. Nicole Nixon, Cap Radio's politics reporter and host of the California State of Mind podcast. I always give that a big push when you're on because it's a great podcast.
Thank you.
Go subscribe right now. Nicole, thank you.
Thanks, Randall.
As we mentioned earlier in the show, only one time in California state history has a gubernatorial recall effort made it to voters, and it was a success for those working to get then-Governor Gray Davis out of office. On August 10th, 2003, Mark Sandlow, who was then with the San Francisco Chronicle, spoke on C-SPAN's Washington Journal about the then-current updates surrounding the recall against Davis. Let's listen to some of his explanation.
Now we have a vague sense as to what the California recall ballot will look like. We have about 130 folks who filed the proper papers, or at least the papers, to run for governor in California. Now the Secretary of State will have to go through the signatures and figure out who's in, who's out. But at this point, it certainly looks like, barring a last-minute court decision, that come early October, there'll be a recall vote on Governor Gray Davis. Do you want him thrown out of office, yes or no? And on the right-hand side of the ballot will be a list. Figure all 130 of them won't make it, but with probably in excess of 100 candidates running to replace Gray Davis.
Well, in the end, there were 135 candidates on the ballot. In October of 2003, the special election, recall election, was held, where the ballot first, as he pointed out, asked voters if they wanted to recall the then governor. And then the following question asked, who should it be? Just 11 months into his second term, Davis was voted out of office. Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger won that election with about 48% of the vote. He took office November 17th that same year. We spoke with former Governor Gray Davis about his experience as the only governor in California history to be recalled and touched on current events that Governor Newsom is currently dealing with. I started by asking him about what he thought the recall movement against Newsom would ultimately fail.
First of all, to qualify, you probably need about 2 million signatures that you submit because you need 1.5 million. I think early on, the proponents put in about 725,000, about 440 qualified. So that's still a ways to go with the 36 days left. But even if they do qualify, the most recent polls show that Gavin Newsom is still ahead. The people who prefer he stay in office is still ahead of the people who want to oust him from office. And he finally has, meaning the governor finally has some good news to talk about, namely these vaccines, which were developed in world record time, 11 months. People don't recall this, but it took 4 years for us to develop the last vaccine, which was the mumps. So that is very good news. And as we speak, they're putting shots in arms. And the governor had the good news to announce last week that Oakland Coliseum is a super site, as is Cal State LA. Kaiser is doing something similar with a site up north and a site down in Cal Poly Pomona. So the more these vaccines, the more super sites open up, the quicker we can get to herd immunity, which I suspect will be sometime this summer. And then this virus will be in the rearview mirror. So I don't think it will qualify, but even if he does, he wins on today's evidence, and the news should be getting better for him and for, more importantly, for people as they get vaccinated. Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned in the lead into this interview, you were recalled in 2003. How do you think your recall effort compares to the one Gavin Newsom is experiencing right now?
It is totally different. And let me give you two quick reasons. First of all, President Bush was not for me. President Biden is totally behind Gavin and was instrumental in getting those two super sites open, Oakland and Cal State LA. And I assume there's more to come. Mm-hmm. Equally, although maybe more important, is the percentage of Republican voters has dropped pretty dramatically. In 2003, they made up 46% of the electorate, and now they're 26% of the electorate. So that's 20 points different. So that means the fate of this recall will be largely in the hands of independents and the Democrats, which is why I think vaccination of more and more people is in everyone's hands and is likely to put the governor in better position in the summer, but he's already in good enough position to hold on today if the election were today.
Mm-hmm. Republican Congressman Darrell Issa of San Diego County, who helped fund your recall effort back in 2003, says what the recall offers is an opportunity for the governor and for the state to change the direction it's going. Do you think that's what's behind this effort, not to actually remove Newsom from office, but to push him more to the center, possibly bring more Republicans to the bargaining table?
Well, recalls are a serious business, and the attempt is to put before the electorate a different election. In my case, it was the third election. I got elected in 98, re-elected in 2002, recalled in 2003. A separate election and a different election. It's only like 80 or 90 days after the Secretary of State certifies the election, and it's winner take all. There's about, I think it was 134 people running in my race. So I think Arnold got 39% of the vote or something like that, but or 41% of the vote, but that was all it took. So there's no primary, there's no challenge, just one election, less time to vet. So I think it's more than just trying to move the governor to a different ideological position. I think it's trying to win the governorship. And frankly, the Republicans haven't had a lot of luck in winning elections straight up. I think the last one was 2008 statewide. So this may be a more common phenomenon going forward.
Mm-hmm. And this election, a recall election, it's not inexpensive, right? How much does it cost the state to put one of these on?
I think you'd have to check the Secretary of State, but I think at the very low end, it's in the $50 to $60 million range, and it can go up to $75 million.
Mm-hmm. The energy crisis was a big issue for you. Where do you feel the state is now when it comes to energy, with public safety shutoffs expected each fall and then last summer rolling blackouts during a heat wave? Has the state properly addressed its energy problems?
You'll pardon me for taking a trip down memory lane here, but one of the things I'm proudest of is in the midst of this recall, we were able to not only approve, but build far more plants than the state had ever built. We approved 33 plants, 25 were online when I left office, which is more power than all the governors since World War II put online together. And that provided us a 20-year head start. And when I say online, I mean this power was contracted for in the main. We're not buying in the spot market. Today, we have to get rid of about 25 or 30% of our power late in the day, and then import another 25 or 30% from the far west. That is pretty dicey, and we did have a couple days in August of, I think it was 19, where the power was out for 2 or 3 days. But I think that was more the ISO, the Energy Commission, and the PUC not really focusing on having real power in reserve each day. I made sure that we had reserve power, which was contracted for, not competing on the spot market for it, which they do now. 25% of the power minimum has to be imported late in the day, about 5 o'clock. At least half of that was contracted for when I was governor. So that means it was a certainty you would get that power, as opposed to hopefully you can get it and you have no idea how much high a price you have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Now, so, is that costly? Yes, it's costly. But the cost of a blackout is extraordinarily high in what I like to believe is California's most innovative state. I remember having a press conference with all the CEOs, starting with the head of Intel back in 2001. And the CEO said, "Can you guarantee me that we won't lose power?" And I said, There was nothing I'd rather guarantee you than that, but I can't guarantee you. In fact, they never did lose power. We've moved heaven and earth to make sure that didn't happen, but we couldn't guarantee it. And so if we're going to have the leading technology state in the country, we cannot have blackouts, period, end of story.
Yeah. So do you think that we have enough power, or are you saying with the PUC and CAISO that we're just not managing it properly?
I'm saying we need to contract for some of that power we import every day, because it's a different problem than I had. The real problem I had was Enron was stealing power. They literally shut off power one day, 4 days after several of us met with them at the White House's urging to see if we could work out a solution. But the five four people I had with me, two Republican legislators, two Democratic legislators, agreed we're not going to punish the ratepayers because the ratepayers didn't ask for energy deregulation. This was the energy company's idea. So we said no. 4 days later, the power went off in San Francisco. I suspected something was rotten in Denmark. But 6 months after I'm out of office, all these videos came out. Enron is calling their plant in Vegas, which is servicing San Francisco. Are you busy today? No, not so busy. Well, why don't you go down? Totally blacked out a day and a half after Bush was inaugurated into office at a time of the year when you have two times as much power as you need. So that was a criminal act for which Enron as a company was never punished for, but the CEO went to prison for 19 years. The chairman was convicted, but died before he could go to prison. And several other ranking Enron officials were convicted and went to prison. And like seven weeks after that video was shown, Enron ceased to exist. Mm-hmm. The seventh largest company in the world ceased to exist. So it was a total con job, but I never had the proof to demonstrate that until those videos came out, which was too late for me. But in this situation, the pandemic is in all 50 states. If you look at the per capita rankings, California is doing far better than people think we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, you didn't face a pandemic, but you're certainly watching it carefully under this administration. There have been some major missteps. The EDD was met with a huge uptick in unemployment benefit applications, and that entity has been scrutinized by many who have been left without benefits. Fraud has been rampant as well. As governor, how can you step in to ensure that those things that need help are getting it?
Well, my heart goes out to people who are waiting for their unemployment checks. They deserve it. They're entitled to it, in part because the government was the one that asked them to basically stay home and not work. And these problems were basically known 10 years ago. And nothing happened over those 10 years to improve the infrastructure. But here are the big ticket items, some of which are underway. So California is one of only three states that does not allow a direct option, meaning a direct deposit option for EDD applicants to get the money directly deposited in their bank account. They are starting to do that now administratively. There's legislation to require that. It's one of a handful of states that doesn't require you to make cross-check with the prison population to make sure these checks are not going out in the names of people currently incarcerated. That's not what they were for. That's not what they should be for. And finally, to the people starting, I think, in December, whose checks were held up, over $1.4 billion worth of checks, because they wanted to make sure there was no fraud associated with it. They had no inkling that there was a fraud, but they were just freaked out by the fraud that currently was exposed by two state audits. I mean, you need like a SWAT task team on that, moving heaven and earth to process these people quickly so they can get their checks. And my guess is 70 or 80% of them are totally legitimate applications, and they should have the money like yesterday.
Could Governor Newsom done more?
I think he's on the right track. It's, unfortunately, it's a slow bureaucracy. It doesn't have a great computer system. That's something Sacramento hasn't done very well under any governor. But this is urgent. People are desperate. They're out of money. They don't have a job. We owe this to people. And so I think we can always do more. I don't have any specific proposals other than I've suggested, but I would throw everything I can at this to get those checks out to the people who deserve it. If you got to process them, I understand that, to make sure that the claims are valid. But as soon as they're valid, see if you can get a direct deposit program right to their bank. Because those people, you know, their case is very compelling. We just can't turn a blind eye to that.
Mm-hmm. So California had a budget surplus going into 2020. Very impressive one. Then we had a surprising amount of money for 2021. The Legislative Analyst's Office released a report showing that as time goes on, the state will face a budget shortfall. What can Governor Newsom or future governors do in order to start climbing out of this shortfall that was established, you know, really it was created, I should say, by the pandemic?
There's a number of legislators considering long-term reforms. And I hope that gets on the legislative agenda in the next year or two. I worked on something actually with George Shultz, our wonderful former Secretary of State who passed on last couple of days, on a commission. We named it after his autobiography, Think Long. We had Condi Rice and George Shultz and Governor Schwarzenegger, myself, Jerry Brown, Willie Brown.
Real bipartisan mix there.
It was meant to have a bipartisan consensus. So we came up with this idea, which makes sense from a political science perspective. It's not necessarily the most popular idea, but to avoid what I call the feast and famine of budgeting, where you get a lot of money, you spend it, and then 3 years later you have less money and you have to take some of it back. Very painful. You would reduce everyone's income tax by about a third. But then you would start putting a 1 or 2% taxes on legal fees, accounting fees, that part of the service economy that's not taxed. And that's because when the tax, sales tax was first originated, I think in the 1900s, we were largely a manufacturing economy, and now we're largely a service economy. So it's only the manufacturing part of the economy that's bearing the brunt of the tax. So that's an idea. There may be other ideas, but clearly the economy is going to have expansive years and it's going to contract. And that's just like the tide. It goes in, it goes out. There's no escaping that. So then the question is, how do you avoid spending too much money in good years when everyone says, well, we have the money to spend it. Why don't you spend it? And then no money in the bad years to draw upon a reserve to help people when they also need help. So that's a big problem. Thank you for identifying it. As I say, this idea makes sense to a political scientist that I just explained to you, but not particularly popular.
Yeah. Gray Davis, former Democratic governor of California. I know you've been really busy lately, so thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
And still ahead, we'll speak with the pollster who was with Governor Davis back in 2003 and was involved in two of the three gubernatorial recalls in U.S. history. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Over the past 20 years, there have been two gubernatorial recalls that have made it to the ballot in the United States. The one against Davis in 2003 that we just discussed, of course. And then back in 2012, there was one against Republican governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker. In the entire history of our nation, there have been only three. The third was in North Dakota in 1921 against Republican Lynn Frazier. Our next guest had a front row seat to the most recent two recall efforts. Political pollster Paul Maslin was the strategist for Governor Gray Davis, and he worked on the effort to recall Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. So he joins us now from that state's capital, Madison. Paul, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Randall. Glad to be here. I wasn't part of the North Dakota one. I can absolve myself of any responsibility there.
Right. I consider myself a Madisonian, even though I was born and raised here in California, but I'm proud to have lived 6.5 years in your fantastic city. I love Madison with all my heart.
Where it's 5 degrees right now, but it's a great place.
My cold heart, I guess. So tell me, Paul, what fuels a recall movement? You've been right there at the heart of them.
Well, the two that, and now a third, we're witnessing, there has to be some grassroots dimension to it. And I think as Governor Davis was alluding to, even though it's tough to get these signatures, generally, if the grassroots motivation is there, and if there are actors on the other side who decide it's in their interest to push that grassroots effort and get the signatures, then they're going to qualify. We learned that the hard way. There was a lot of talk in 2003 about, oh, they won't get on the ballot. This is hard. That nobody's done this before. And yet they qualified. And the same was true in Wisconsin. By the time that measure really got rolling, there were a lot of Democrats who realized that it was not necessarily going to be a wise thing to do, or the chances weren't going to be great. We had no chance of stopping it from getting on the ballot, though. And I think in this case, there's enough grassroots feeling and opposition to the governor on the pandemic and issues related to that. I think it'll qualify.
We're hearing some of that same talk, though, you know, defense saying that it couldn't possibly succeed. We just heard that actually from the man that you worked for, Governor Davis. Yeah. What are your thoughts? Should it make the ballot?
I think for reasons that Gray mentioned, I do think that Gavin has got more advantages here. In some ways, more similar to Walker's case. I think the fact that, it's related to the pandemic, and there are clear actionable things that can happen in terms of vaccinations, in terms of getting people economic relief, in terms of the economy starting to rebound, that maybe the worst has passed for him in that regard. Secondly, this is happening in the middle of his first term and presumably would be on the ballot a little over a year from the actual date where he would be up for re-election in Wisconsin. That was not true with Gray Davis. We had been through a re-election campaign. We're coming on the heels of that. He's now in his second term, essentially as a lame duck. In Walker's case in Wisconsin, clearly there were voters in the middle who ultimately said, why am I being asked to do this a year and a half into this guy's governorship? Why can't I wait for the ordinary time and give him a chance to do whatever he's going to do, plus or minus, and ultimately have a judgment in 2014. So I think that'll help Governor Newsom in that respect.
We are here in Sacramento, after all. So if perchance Governor Newsom is listening right now, what would you most want to tell him regarding his, you know, key or best moves to avoid impeachment moving forward?
Recall, not impeachment, but I know we get
confused. I'm sorry. yeah,
too many things happening at once.
The day, right? Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Recall.
I would say three things. One, pandemic. Just, and he knows that already. But just do everything possible as governor to deal with it. Secondly, take this seriously. Don't listen to the people who say, well, there's this percent chance that they won't qualify in the signatures. The signature gathering business in California is a very Byzantine, arcane kind of process. But the bottom line is, I think with social media and other mechanisms, they have the ability to get the signatures. The third thing I would say is to try to impose some discipline. Yes, we had 134 candidates, but the one that mattered the most, other than Arnold Schwarzenegger, who became a star, obviously was a star, but was sort of the star of that show, was Cruz Bustamante. There was an effort made among other Democrats to say, well, okay, there are these wacko situation where Davis is up or down, but we also have a ballot. We better have a good candidate. Unfortunately, that set up a dynamic where there were some Democrats who thought, well, okay, it's not so bad if Gray loses because we can get Cruz here to win on the actual ballot. We won't lose anything. That's a false way of thinking. I think Gavin needs to try to ensure as best he can that there is not a serious Democrat running in the separate ballot question, and that the real focus is up or down on Gavin Newsom. And if you reject the recall, it doesn't matter who's running for governor on the same ballot.
Who are the California Democrats right now that could potentially fill that Bustamante role?
I'm not going to name one, even if I knew. I don't think there are people that serious. That was the lieutenant governor of the state. I mean, they had run together. Obviously, they got there separately. We don't have tickets in the primary, but they had run together the previous year for re-election in 2002. So I don't think there's anybody of that prominence. Could there be someone trying to make a name for themselves? Somebody who just figures, let me try to get some name recognition? That's not the same thing, though. I think if it's an obscure legislator or even a member of Congress or somebody who really doesn't have a strong base in the party, then you worry less about it. The bottom line is, and the governor said this, Gray Davis said it, if Gavin Newsom can keep, the Democratic Party is much stronger today than it was in 2003. If he can keep Democrats and like-minded independents pretty solid, ultimately, whatever criticism they might have about the pandemic, solidly behind the notion that we don't want to throw him out of office, then I think he will survive and perhaps pretty easily.
Yeah. Paul, we have about a minute left. Social media did not play a role in 2003. In 2012, it might have played a bit of a role there with Walker. How do you see that playing out now?
I think it's a motivator. It could work on both sides. We know that the right wing has obviously, in the whole Trump era, has used it for its own devices. We saw a hideous example. And by the way, that hideous example of January 6th also gives Gavin Newsom some ammunition, wrong term. But he's got the ability to say, you know, here we go again. This is crazy talk. And some of the same people or people of the same like that are doing this that were storming the Capitol in 2000 and in January of 2021. Mm-hmm. So it becomes an aggravant. I think it helps motivate the other side in a way that they were also motivated in 2003, not the same mechanism, but different reasons. And yeah. Schwarzenegger became a media star. It's problematic, but it is beatable.
All right. Political pollster Paul Maslin was the strategist for Governor Gray Davis, and he worked on the effort to recall Wisconsin Governor Walker. Really appreciate your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Randall.
Okay, and that does it for Insight for today. Everything available at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez, Kyle McKinnon, managing editor Aram Sarkissian, digital team Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata, technical director Mark Jones, engineer Antonio Munez. If the schedule in Washington, D.C. holds, we will not have a show tomorrow. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us today.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.